Score, the podcast. The only show taking you inside the studios of the world's most celebrated composers and musicians.
It's been a while, Robert. It's good to see you, man.
See me? Why, thanks.
We're very excited to be joined today by, let me get all of this in here, multiple Emmy-nominated and BAFTA-winning composer of BBC's War and Peace, Peaky Blinders, Black Mirror, The Crown, and Ridley Scott's new biopic, Napoleon, starring Joaquin Phoenix. I'm, of course, talking about Maestro Martin Phipps. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, that's great. Maestro Martin Phipps. Martin, it's been kind of remarkable that we've had this show for 5 years and have never had you as a guest. It's kind of nuts.
Well, better late than never. It's great to be here.
I appreciate that. That's so nice. And lots to talk about. As I was saying just before we started, I did such a deep dive on your opus, and we have a lot of questions, but it led me down the rabbit hole, and I've just before we started listened, as you will know why, to Benjamin Britten. And the name has come up twice this week. Reading a review of the movie, ironically, Maestro, starring Bradley Cooper, about Leonard Bernstein, Benjamin Britten's name came up, and I thought, that's funny. It's a name you don't hear that much right now. And then I read that he was your godfather. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. And I think Maestro is an amazing film, and they really captured, I kind of grew up in that world, weirdly. As a young kid, my parents were Britten and Pierce's agents. And they lived in a little studio next to our house in London. When they were in London, they were living next door to us with a connecting door. And I saw all this kind of amazing talent of 60s, 70s, 80s, let's say 70s, 80s, I'm not that old. And coming through the house, Rostropovich and I think even Shostakovich came through on tour, but that was before I was, that was before my day, but amazing talent, and Jesse Norman, and amazing singers.
You were kind of born into this. Was music something you were interested in, or was this the classic, like, now Marty, you have to go to piano lessons?
Yeah. Well, there was plenty of that. I really rejected it when I hit my teens, and because I grew up completely immersed in this classical world. And then, you hit your teens, and it's not what's cool or sexy. So you go and do something else. And I was really into bands then, and wanted to be in bands. But then once I sort of found the writing to picture, being part of a film sort of story idea, and I've slowly come back to the classical world, and inevitably with scores. And I realize how much of that early stuff is in me still. That what I grew up with, and it always is. What you grow up with is just embedded in you, and you can't do anything about, you can't really do much about that.
I love that. I really love everything you just said, that you came back, but that it was embedded in you. You must have been, not only embedded, but with that exposure, it was soaked into your being. And so
soaked is a very good word. Yeah.
I mean, I'd like to know, these are such interesting paths that every composer takes, and people always ask, how did you get into it? And you can hardly tell them, like, I don't know, man, this accidental thing happened. And
yeah, there's no normal way in, it seems like.
They think there's a kind of magic ticket. Was there a moment where you were playing in a band, and I've got to imagine age-wise, it might be late 70s, 80s, maybe mid-80s,
mid-80s, wavy,
funky. Maybe it's even the video killed the radio star moment.
MTV. The Hans's moment.
Hans
on
and
there.
Trevor.
Yeah.
But
right,
was there
right,
a moment
right.
where this idea of writing, first of all, I imagine on paper, I don't know if Performer 1.0 had come out, which changed a lot of lives, but did you think, I could compose instead of just being in a band, and I could compose the picture?
Totally. And it was a real light bulb moment for me, and a great thing about, I think, a great advocate for education. I went to college just because I wanted to go to university. In those days in Britain, you didn't have to pay huge fees to go there. And I went to do drama because I wanted to go to university, but I didn't want to study music because music was pretty deadly in those days. And it was very traditional, very classical, and not like the kind of options you have now to study music. But I was terrible at acting, really appalling. And I don't know why they even let me on there, and didn't even realize I had to act, really. And so to get out of acting for the plays, I started writing the music for the plays. And
it was perfect.
A real, real fantastic light bulb moment for me. And I realized that I could do this on my own. I could be part of a narrative. I could be part of another world and a story, which just the combination of the two really excited me. I didn't have to work with my my arsehole band members anymore. No offense.
I think I know those guys. They're in every band.
Right. And then it was just like, that was fantastic. It was like, yeah, absolutely, this is what I want to do. So to go back, music was hardly an inspired choice for me. It was very much a sort of in my blood from the family. I was hardly breaking out with it. But that leap to writing to picture and being part of a narrative, that's something that I really excites me. And at no point do I feel like a frustrated composer, that I'd really rather be writing symphonies or operas or anything like that. I love writing to picture, and that's a really, really special thing for me.
That's
what
really
was your
interesting.
Very first writing to picture, moment.
The very first play, it was some restoration drama we were doing. I mean, I think it was pretty terrible. But I suddenly, you know, I got on a little primitive keyboard that had a slight harpsichord sound, and I was away. And you know, suddenly it was that narrative was great.
Going back to writing for your drama, you know, in university, you were kind of running from that style of music. You discovered that acting wasn't for you, but did you offer that up? Did someone say, hey, Martin can write this kind of music? Like, that wasn't something you wanted to do at that point, right? And how did you jump back into it?
I mean, I was very happy to do the music because I loved music. So it suddenly was like, oh my, but the initial motivation was, how do I get out of acting? Because this is so terrible and it's so embarrassing and I'm so not suited to it. So that was the thing. But, you know, like many things in life, you come to it through a different way. You know, what seems like a bad situation actually can be a very good one.
Oh, I love that. It's a positive spin. Do you know the similarity between your path and Patrick Doyle's?
No, I have met Patrick, actually. I remember him coming to talk at the National Film School when I was there. Did he do a similar thing?
It just occurs to me that he was in Edinburgh in acting, and one of his mates was Kenneth Branagh.
Of course, of course, yes.
And I just, when you said it, I thought, and they were putting on a show, and Kenneth said, you play, don't you play piano or something? And P.S., he ends up becoming just like you.
Yeah.
That rang his bell. It was like, what am I doing getting into costumes?
Right.
I should be getting a little band together. That's so
great. Well, that's a really nice connection. Yeah.
I'm just curious, as a frustrated orchestrator, arranger, and everything, all that Benjamin Britten, Jesse Norman, Rostropovich coming through, was writing, literally notating, second nature to you? Literally scribbling.
No,
parts.
I mean, look, okay, Robert and Kenny, I have to admit to you, and anyone who knows me who knows this already, my musical skills are really pretty limited. They're certainly, you know, I'm not related by blood to Benjamin Britten, and it was certainly nothing got transmuted in the gene pool through my family to me. I am very average in my musical abilities. My piano playing is ropey, and I can just about bash out my own stuff. But no, it's not like I can't read a score and compress it down and play it on the piano like, you know, really skilled conductors can, transposing six parts at the same time. None of that. But I think weirdly it actually helped me in my world, because it made me work with, you know, I'm a three chord, four chord guy, and I actually have quite a pop sensibility, even though I bring it into a classical world. And it made me be simple and make those three or four chords work, and the limited musical understanding that I had really worked for me and connect with me. And what I think I'm good at is making it connect for the listener and other people who might not be, you know, super classical.
I think it's great to learn that. First of all, kind of a relief in some bizarre way, that because several of us out here are self-conscious that we didn't have that incredible education. And, you know, and of course, you get next to some of the composers that work and they say, you know, this reminds me of Mahler's 42nd. And you know, shoot, I don't even know the reference.
Did he write that many?
Right. It's kind of curious that you're the Martin Phipps reputation is so the crown and kind of classical moments and he must be this kind of I don't even have to wake up to get the London Phil to do what I need. Though I must admit, Peaky Blinders, I was surprised in the beginning. I know that you worked on that in the beginning. Yeah. Of course, I remember thinking, well, this is kind of like blues rock. This is so cool.
Well, look, that was my kind of composer's hat on. And it wasn't a natural thing. I mean, that was a little while ago. And I was still sort of, I think, probably finding my voice a little bit. But it was... What it was I was approached by a really good director who was, you know, buzzing on this series, and it was the early days of it, and I saw it and it was just brilliant, and it was like, well, I've got to do this. It wasn't the most exciting project to work on as a composer, because the director, Otto Bathurst, already had chosen this blues rock kind of vibe, which was great, but he had tracks all over it, you know, the Nick Cave track for the title music, and I think he would have licensed everything if he could have done. You know, he had tracks all over the temp track. So it was really, as a composer, it was replacing some of those and filling the gaps and stuff. So it wasn't super rewarding, but what was rewarding was working on such a groundbreaking kind of quality piece of drama, which that is.
And I was confused, and it's subsequently been explained, that it was done with, and forgive me for not understanding this, Merle. Mm. And can you just share with us what exactly Merle is? Because I thought that was a person.
No, that is my sort of company, and it was something I set up to kind of be able to do collaborations. And actually, I mean, this is getting pretty nerdy here, and please do cut
this
out.
We like nerdiness. We're nerds.
Okay. So in the UK, if you do music for a show, a BBC show, which is what Peaky Blinders was to start off with before it got picked up by Netflix and became this kind of worldwide smash, you can put pretty much any track you want on it, and you don't have to pay anything. They've got a blanket license agreement. So Otto Bathurst had put all these Jack White tracks and Dylan and Tom Waits and stuff all over it, and it was fantastic. But then suddenly it was like, okay, well, we've got to do a worldwide version now. And this was before Netflix picked it up, and the worldwide version for us in those days was just like, this is a bit of a pain, but, you know, we'll do it. This is fun. And the production company said, look, can you get a band together and replace some of these tracks? And so that's how I put Merle together and got some guys in and had great fun re-recording these tracks, not thinking that a lot of them would really ever get heard outside sort of obscure parts of Eastern Europe, maybe. Certainly not in America.
Yeah. The original show aired with Needle Drops and then replaced for the Netflix version.
Yeah, exactly. And the Netflix version just happened to be the worldwide version that we did at the time, but we didn't know it was going to get picked up by Netflix. We didn't really even think it was going to the States. And
that's wild.
Suddenly, actually, so what you're seeing has got a lot of stuff that I did with this band on it. You know, a real shame, actually, we've never released it. You know, that's the real
shame.
There's been some attempts to, but I don't know quite whatever happened with that.
What a great opportunity to... Yeah. That music is super cool. And I know that, I mean, my understanding of London geography is minimal, but after watching the cool series Top Boy, I know where London Fields is, and that's where you recorded?
Right. Right. Yeah, yeah. This is where I'm based. It's Hackney. It's East London. It's the cool bit of London.
Are you a Hackney diamond of some variety?
I am. I was born about a mile from here. So yeah, yeah. I haven't gone very far. I've really gone nowhere. In fact, I've haven't managed to leave the place of my birth at all.
I actually like to. I'm curious about that because, Martin, of course, we're sitting in Los Angeles in the some version of one of the engine rooms of film music, and London may be the other, and maybe New York to a certain degree, and then Nashville comes on, and Prague and all that. But when you say that you haven't really moved off of that square so much, is that by commission, by omission? Have you been in Hollywood more than I'm aware?
Robert, I haven't really. I mean, I made quite a conscious decision to stay in London, and perhaps when, you know, really I should have gone in my 20s to LA, and especially at that time when London was a smaller place in terms of the film music scene. And that has changed and shifted, and I feel like, you know, it was the right decision, because this is where my life is and my friends and my family. And so once I'd passed that point of my 20s and into my 30s and settling down and having kids, to relocate would have been really hard. And by that point, London was becoming more interesting. And really in the last 10 years, it's sort of got its international mojo going, and certainly in terms of what comes out of here and productions that do. So it's actually a really exciting place to be now, and of course I do come to LA, but not that much, you know. And I know my profile has struggled a little bit as a result of that, but you know, it's just the decisions you make.
You realize the irony is, as we all know, is that it's this moment in your life that suddenly LA is going to beckon, and
now that you said
you're going to be faced with a great riddle of, God, they want me to be in Los Angeles for the next year working on
technology has made it so you don't really have to now. I mean, it's probably easier than ever to be far away. So
I absolutely, it really is. It's changed. I mean, I've got this lovely studio and nobody ever comes to it anymore. You know, it's because of, since COVID, it's like, it's just such a shame. I mean, it was already happening a bit, but now it's all, we just send stuff to the edit, and that's, you know, it's all done there. But I mean, look, if that's that way it is, I mean, luckily my kids are now nearly grown up. So I, you know, I could come out for a bit. So,
perfect,
you know,
timing.
Don't let that hold anyone back. So
that could be the tagline for this episode. Martin's kids are grown, bring him to LA. I want to ask you a question about that. Kenny, I'm hammering away because I'm so interested, and then you may even get a word in edgewise. Maybe.
There's a small movie we do want to touch about that might be out right now.
We're going to get to that next. I want to ask your opinion of something you just said. I did a Zoom yesterday with a young perspiring composer, just, you know, one of those things, a favor to a friend of a friend, and he asked me if it was important to have the director in the room with him, or can he do it all on Zoom, because he's been doing it on Zoom since COVID. And without giving it away, I'd be curious. I mean, we it's a kind of multi answer, but what would you say?
Well, it's interesting. I think having face-to-face time, proper contact time, is invaluable. And certainly you need to have that at some point. The idea of doing a whole show remotely feels really strange to me. Sometimes I think the advantage of doing stuff remotely is it gives the directors and everybody else a chance to listen to your music and see what they feel about it, really sort of assess it a bit. The thing about playing in a room, being in a studio, playing it to them directly, is they have to respond straight away to stuff. And actually sometimes that's not, it's better that they have a little bit of a time to think about it and try it in the edit and mess around it a bit with themselves. So that's trying to sort of find the positives of a remote relationship. But generally that being in the room time is invaluable. And, you know, that's what I, just to jump ahead, Kenny, to your no doubt next question, is the the contact time I got with Ridley Scott was invaluable and really, really rewarding.
Tell us.
Yeah, let's shift to that. You first time working with Ridley Scott, huge movie, yeah. Or was it? Did you guys
no first time? No, first time. Okay. No connection at all. I think it was well, I know it was because of The Crown. He really liked what I'd done on The Crown and was just, you know, in an immutable fashion, he makes a decision very quickly and he's like, yep, get me the guy who's doing that. And that was the end of the conversation, really. So it was, which was fantastic to be, you know, to get on a big film like that without the sort of jumping through loads of hoops and having to prove, you know, even if you proved yourself in other ways, prove it, yeah, I haven't done a big film like that. And, you know, just to be sort of said, okay, yeah, we trust you, off you go, is just so great.
We talk a lot about on this show about secondhand and when you develop that with, you know, a partner in a director and a composer. But when you come on to something this size, big studio film, Ridley Scott, a legendary director, you know this is going to be big. How do you speed that up and get to that level so quickly on your first time working together?
I mean, I think I think the fear was more in my, you know, was in my head. It was, and you mustn't let that hold you back or be too awed by what you're doing or the circumstances you're in. Otherwise, it's going to paralyze you. And you just have to trust. And that's what was so great about Ridley going, look, I like what you do and I want you to do it. And so I was just had to just pretend it was like another job and get on and do it and do what I instinctively thought. And he was, while he gave me some great direction and really interesting steers and talking a lot about Napoleon's character and how he wanted the music to reflect that, he didn't micromanage me or was sort of, you know, throwing temps at me and saying it's got to be like this. So it was that real faith and trust in his creators, which I think he has in all his departments. And it's very much, you go off and do your stuff now. That's why you're here, to do that. And that was just fantastic.
Did he speak to you in like emotions when you're discussing that, or does he speak musically?
Yeah. No, I mean, he will reference tracks and he will, you know, talk about stuff. And he was very clear he wanted a singular theme that wasn't too classical in a sort of posh, you know, very polished way. He wanted something a little rougher and folky almost. And he talked a lot about Napoleon's character and how he was not the polished aristocrat of his peers in the French army, and he was an outsider, crucially, you know, from Corsica. And he gave some brilliant references, like the Corsican Singers was very much his lead, and that's he'd sort of fallen in love with that, and the idea of these sort of, you know, it was almost like a shepherd's call on the mountains of Corsica, and you know that was sort of Napoleon's background, and sort of, you know, and that was in him, and he was soaked in that, put it that way, and he wanted to reflect that in the music at all turns. So we really tried to keep it simple, keep it a little rough around the edges, and follow that journey, you know, that Ridley was trying to describe to me.
It almost feels like there's a couple cues that made me think of the scenes in The Godfather in Sicily, where it's kind of folky music, watching Al Pacino. And I thought, this is very different from the expectation of this is going to be bombastic or heavy electronics.
Yeah.
You know, here's this, we're going to do a modern Napoleon. It was like Nino Rota sort of meets, you know, it's just, which is a nice company for you to be in, because it's one, some of my favorite music.
Well, I think it was trying to be a bit classic in classic film school terms a little bit. And yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, when we did the tune on the trumpet, it has that slightly mafioso feel. It was about, I mean, there are some big moments in the score, obviously. You know, we some of the battle stuff gets huge, but I don't think we ever lose sight of the personal in it. And, you know, Ridley's pictures are so enormous and his battle scenes are so incredible, and the sound team do an incredible job on the, you know, on this raw, visceral cannon fodder that's being served up. And so the music can occupy a different space and be really quite personal. and intimate with us, you know. And I think we're doing that with Napoleon's theme and the idea we have for Josephine, and quite a few moments where it's really about us, just the audience, just being with this singular character amongst all this mayhem, you know.
That's a really nice thing. Go ahead, Kenny.
I was just going to say you're able to kind of accentuate that with a score that is just a solo piano at times. And I know that there's a story out there that I love when composers do this, because you totally don't have to do this. And unless you talked about it in an article, no one would ever know, but you go out of your way to find a piano that Napoleon actually owned in a museum. Can you tell us first off how you even found that out? And then what goes into that? Do you go to a museum and record there? Do you have it moved? I mean, that seems like a big haul.
Right, right. Well, listen, I have to give credit to my agent. He literally he rang me up super excited, you know, shortly after I'd got the gig, and was like, oh, I've heard of this. There's a piano just outside London that belonged to Napoleon, and we have to go and see it. And I was a bit like, okay, maybe, you know, let's just see if that's the right, you know, we're not going to put that in there just because it's Napoleon's piano. It has to have some kind of contextual, you know, justification. And but you know, it was just outside London, and we took a little couple of mics down there and a recording team, and went down and had a play on it. And it was so full of life and such a distinct sound, and the history was just dripping off it, and I couldn't resist it. And it was really. Yeah, I mean, it's not all over the score by any means, but it's in a couple of key places, and it's really lovely, I think, when it comes. So,
were they nervous about allowing you to touch the keyboard?
Well, no, they let us play it without any problem. We couldn't move it. And
does Daryl get a shout out? I stayed till the bitter end, and I'm now wondering if Daryl, you know, piano care of.
Piano Daryl. Found by, yeah, right. Conceived piano by. I don't think so, and that's now you're making me think. Damn, I should have given him a little acknowledgement there.
You know, it's a little bit of. He could have said, you know, we have Napoleon's tricorn hat here. I think you should wear it while you compose. Finding the piano, I think.
But that's almost the equivalent of it. You know, it was nice. Exactly.
But what did Ridley think of that? I'm curious when you told him.
I think
him,
like, he liked it. I mean, I think he liked it. You know, I don't know. I never actually had a conversation, you know, very directly about that. And a lot of my conversation with Ridley were very much at the beginning of the process. And, you know, and then once we delivered, you know, he just told me he was really happy. So I hopefully it resonated with him too.
That's why he's a great director. Because he didn't say, is that a clarinet? You know, do we have to have snare drums?
Exactly. Is that a bit plinky? Is that, you know, is that a bit out of tune, that instrument? Exactly. No, it's 1806. Yeah. And it's really, look, if you don't mind me again being a little bit nerdy, the whole experience of recording it was fantastic, because it was in this collection of pianos from, it had Haydn's piano, Mahler's piano, J.C. Bach's piano, and Marie Antoinette's piano right next to it.
Any blood on that?
No blood on that. No, but chilling to play it. I mean, really felt
because she
really did. She really did play it. Yeah, and to see the change of the technology of the pianos from 1770, you've basically got a harpsichord. 1830, you've got a fully fledged modern piano, and Napoleon's piano lies about halfway between these two instruments. Yeah. And it's like halfway between a harpsichord and a real piano, and it's very plinky, but it's got a bit more of a sustain to it. And incredible, amazing seeing that technological advancement and how that drove music from the Baroque era right through to the Romantic. And it was, realize it was the technology. It was being able to play a sustain on a piano, hold a chord down and have sustain, whereas a harpsichord, you have to play loads of notes because there's no sustain. You know, you hold down a chord, it's gone in seconds.
Which changes the writing, which... Exactly. Comes all the way through to using Spitfire samples, and we just gave them a free shout out, you know, and changes what you're writing. I do want to just ask, when I was doing the deep Martin Phipps dive, the very first thing of the film you scored, War and Peace, or the show, says Napoleon, you know, has just won 1805. He's going to, and I thought, is that where Ridley thought we should get Martin
full
Phipps?
Circle? Or,
you know,
full circle. Yeah, I don't. He never said that was something. I don't think it. You know, I don't. It was a great series. I got a lot of time for it, but I don't think it was big in America. I think it was on AMC maybe, or imagine not even that. Actually, I think it was something more obscure. But it was, yeah. And he never referenced that, but we did use some material from that. I don't know if you noticed or heard that soundtrack, but no, they tempted up with some stuff from War and Peace and really loved that. And it was like, well, look, this is, I own this, you know, you can have it if you want. And it works really well. So we had to re-record it because we didn't own the recordings. But yeah, it's great to have. I mean, I don't know if you remember the Borodino sequence in the film.
Tell me, which one is called the Borodino sequence?
So Borodino is the Russian campaign. So it's that whole sequence where he's coming into Russia. They get attacked by Cossacks.
They tell him to go back, and he says, we're pushing forward.
Yeah, we're pushing on, exactly. That whole sequence and the burning of Moscow and all of that was that, you know, those were little bits from War and Peace in there. And that was really lovely to see that get a proper airing. You know, people will really hear that now, which is really nice for me.
Wow, you can reuse it in Napoleon II when Hollywood decides.
There you go. It was like that exactly.
Bonaparte too, yeah.
Want to know, Martin, is have you prepared your acceptance speech for, I think,
well,
it's
Robert,
March
that's
10th.
Very kind. I mean, look, I mean, no, is the answer. No, there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of great stuff out there. And I think there's a lot else going on in Napoleon. So I hope that, you know, it's lovely to hear if you think the score's punching through, because I love it. But there's a lot of source tracks in there, and it's kind of a lot of sort of classical stuff from the day. And so it's, you know, it's quite hard to get the score to work around that and push. But I hopefully we managed to make it, make its mark.
It did, and you actually described one facet of the score that I'm always amazed by, and it's a tribute not only to you but to the mixers, that you're aware of the score even though there's cannons blowing up everything and gunfire and horses taking a bullet, and you still feel that the composer is helping.
Got to weave through there, yeah.
And so,
right. You could still hear it under all that stuff, could you?
And say, can you guys turn the helicopters up? Because I still hear just a little score. Is there any way you can denigrate?
Yeah. I couldn't possibly comment, Robert, but yes.
Yes.
Martin, how do we...
anything next that you want to share that we can know about?
No, I'm not jumping into anything straight away. I'm looking at a couple of things, but I'm kind of letting this one land a little bit first and see how it sits before I make any. And also, I was doing The Crown at the same time, which was hard work. And although obviously Napoleon took up most of my time, but it was a tough year. So I'm gonna sit back for a little bit and do a bit of R&R and or R&D. I think that's.
Looking back on how we started this discussion, you're rebelling against this music that you were born into and around with your family and your godfather.
Yeah.
2023, you have a Ridley Scott film in theaters in the holiday season. How do you sum up 2023 for Martin Phipps?
Well, I think it's just you never know where life's going to take you. And, you know, like a year ago, a year and a half ago, I had no idea that this was going to happen. And certainly, you know, and you never know how a movie's going to be received. You know, you just absolutely, it's just fantastic to see it, you know, people responding to it. And don't worry, you know, just do your own thing. Don't worry about the future. Just do what you do. And it would be my takeaway from that.
As I was taught long ago, stay out of the results business.
Right.
A composer cannot,
and
you can score a turkey and you never know, it's going to be a huge film. I mean, I've had that experience of working on movies. I thought no one's going to see this. And yet no one could anticipate that a generation hence. I said it recently. I said, I worked on one of those Chipmunks movies, you know, or I worked on all the Chipmunks movies, you know, and it's sort of embarrassing to say. And whoever I was speaking to, you know, they're 20 years old, said, We love those movies. Oh my God. You worked on Shipwrecked, you know. And so you never know something you think. So you stay out of the results business.
Exactly. Don't you let other people make of it what they want and don't worry about it too much. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I have to say the other thing about working on a film this size is that just realizing that I'm a small, you know, hopefully a significant part, but a small part in a huge machine that's got so many moving parts to it. So you just have to let them, you know, everyone else do their stuff too and see what happens in the end.
You're a modest maestro.
Yeah. And we hope to see you walking down some carpets in the next weeks, months.
Go ahead. Thank you. I'd love to come and see you guys when I'm next out. You know, and
They're going to bring you out and trot you through lots of press and red carpet things and as they say, forgive me, pimp you out at all the lunches and dinners that are coming up.
Yeah, I'm cheap. So that's fine.
You're cheap date. So get ready. Just ask for first class travel and a nice hotel room. That's all I can tell you. We will see you out here, of course. And
yeah, looking forward to that.
Really, and
well, I'd love to see you both in person. That would be great.
Yep.
That'd be great. We should set that up. Well, we want to thank you again, Martin Phipps, for joining the show. Go see Napoleon. Check out the score is out on all streaming. And are you going to do a physical vinyl release? Any of that stuff?
Yeah,
any
idea? They are. I believe Sony are doing a vinyl release. So that'll be an awesome thing.
We'll look out for that. Thanks again so much for joining us, Martin. A reminder to our listeners, we're back. We're pumping out episodes here and there. So make sure to follow us, X at Score the Podcast. Facebook, Score a Film Music Documentary, and Instagram at Score Movie. And we will be back with another episode soon. And also, we're on YouTube, too. Make sure to subscribe because we post clips and full interviews like this one with the great maestro, Martin Phipps. Thanks so much, Martin.
Oh, thanks, guys. What a pleasure.
Thank you.